Harper's Magazine, April 2025, under the heading of Report, title, The Social Turn, Psychoanalysis at an Inflection Point, by Maggie Doherty. Maggie Doherty is the author of The Equivalence, A Story of Art, Female Friendship and Liberation in the 1960s, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography. On the morning of February 2, 2023, I exited the subway at 57th Street to find the air growing colder. It had been a warm winter, but the first proper cold front was moving in, and I already felt underdressed. I propelled myself toward the warmth of the Midtown Hilton, where the American Psychoanalytic Association, APSA, as it's styled, was gathering for its winter meeting. APSA has long been the institutional center of psychoanalysts in the United States. Founded in Baltimore in 1911 by, among others, Ernest Jones, Freud's first biographer, its goals were to consolidate the profession and to standardize both training and treatment. Since then, the organization has overseen virtually every aspect of mainstream psychoanalysis in this country. Research, education, and practice, and has resisted changes to many of its standards, casting a suspicious eye on analysts who propose new ideas. In Psychoanalysis, The Impossible Profession, Janet Malcolm described APSA as having an, quote, iron hold, end quote, over psychoanalysis in the United States. The annual in-person meeting, which was traditionally held in New York, is an opportunity for far-flung colleagues, used to working in solitude, to interact. It's also an opportunity to discuss, face-to-face, whether and how their profession might change to meet the historical moment. A second annual meeting held online in June would continue discussions started in New York. Many attendees were clinicians, professionals who had completed many years of psychoanalytic training. I was there as a journalist, an interloper, but I was not unfamiliar with psychoanalysts. For 6 years, I had seen an analyst. I lay on a couch for 50 minutes, 4 days a week, and I spoke about whatever came to mind. An essay I was writing, a dream I'd had, an irksome meeting with a student, a memory from childhood. In time, and in ways entirely mysterious to me, I became a less reactive, more stable person. Someone capable of loving, working, and playing. My treatment had made me curious about psychoanalysis as a profession. But I was in New York mainly to investigate rumors I'd heard about major changes afoot in the American psychoanalytic community. Psychoanalysts, I'd heard, was modernizing. APSA was opening up to the broader world. There was a push to bring in new members, as well as a rising tide of psychoanalytic work that sought to make analysis more accessible to and effective for people of different stripes. I wanted to understand what these changes meant for clinicians and patients, and whether they were being resisted. What would it take for psychoanalysis to change? APSA may have an iron hold on that profession, But it has a small fist, I thought, as I counted the people milling about on the hotel's second floor. It was Thursday, the convention's third day, but only the first with a full slate of panels and discussions. And there were perhaps 50 people present before the afternoon sessions. The crowd seemed old, strikingly so. I saw a lot of gray hair and sensible shoes, and the kind of funky jewelry worn by women of a certain age. According to their name tags, many attendees hail from a few coastal cities: Boston, San Francisco, New York. Almost every person I saw was white. There was a small book exhibit next to a poster display that reminded me of a high school science fair. Representatives from the Mental Health Treatment Center, Austin Riggs, advertising inpatient treatment in the Berkshires, more than $70,000 for 6 weeks, had set up shop just a few steps away. The sleepy atmosphere, the sparse crowd. It was hard to believe that psychoanalysis had once been central to American culture. From the aftermath of World War II through the mid-60s, analysis was seen as a reliable treatment for mental illness. Psychoanalysts sat on the boards of medical schools and chaired departments of psychiatry. Psychoanalytic researchers received government funding. A rosy portrait of the psychoanalyst appeared in the press. Journalists themselves entered treatment. The historian Nathan G. Hale Jr. calls this time the golden age of psychoanalysis. But the golden age didn't last. In the 60s, psychoanalysis came under attack from feminists, as well as from advocates of community mental health services, who derided the practice as a luxury for the well-off. Meanwhile, a new generation of physicians and psychiatrists were turning away from psychoanalysis, particularly with the development of what would later be called cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which was evidence-based and promised concrete results within a set time frame. By the late 70s and early 80s, insurance companies largely excluded psychoanalytic treatment on the grounds that it wasn't evidence-based, and the majority of analysands had to pay out of pocket. In 1980, the third edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders purged its pages of psychoanalytic theory, explicitly bringing American psychiatry into a post-psychoanalytic era that was more focused on, quote, biological, end quote, explanations and cures, like drugs. Soon, pharmaceutical companies began promising patients that their depression or anxiety could be treated with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and by the end of the century, mainstream American psychoanalysts could be said to be on the decline and in crisis. A quarter century later, little has changed. Despite its recent trendiness, articles about Freud and his followers appear in the popular press with surprising frequency. The practice of psychoanalysts is fairly niched. APSA has around 3,500 members, and there are about 10,000 patients currently in analysis in the United States. As of 2018, nearly 40 million Americans were prescribed at least one antidepressant. CBT continues to be regarded as the gold standard, and many insurance plans still refuse to cover psychoanalytic treatment. Few people have the time and money to come in for treatment three or more times a week, and most clinicians spend a good deal of their time doing something other than psychoanalysts. They see patients for psychotherapy, or they teach, or they do consulting work in the public or private sectors. In 2023, 56% of psychoanalysts in ASPA were 70 years old or older. It's no stretch, then, to say that psychoanalysis is dying out. What would it take for the profession to survive? This was one of the implicit questions at the New York meeting, at which institutional changes were to be proposed and new approaches demonstrated. That same afternoon, I found Donald Moss, a longtime chair of APSA's program committee, at a discussion group considering how psychoanalysts might account for social and historical factors while treating patients. An analyst in his late 70s with a rosy complexion and a low, comforting voice, Moss had led this discussion group for many years. His fellow organizers were two practicing clinical psychologists and psychoanalysts: Dorothy Holmes, a professor emerita at George Wilson University, who is widely recognized for her pioneering work on race and gender, and Stephen Seligman, on the faculties of the University of California, San Francisco, and New York University. They had invited Usha Tumala-Nara, a professor of counseling, development, and educational psychology, to present a case study drawn from her private practice that raised questions about how cultural factors, particularly those related to race and ethnicity, might influence clinical work. Roughly 70 audience members, most of whom were themselves therapists, listened to Tumala-Nara, an elegant woman wearing an emerald dress, described several sessions with her patient, whom she had, quote, de-identified, end quote. That is, rendered unrecognizable by omitting personal details. Everyone present had agreed to keep confidential the details of the case. During intermittent pauses in the presentation, participants asked questions. How might the concept of intergenerational trauma apply to the case? How had racism operated on the patient's desires? But some participants, especially older ones, resisted this approach. A white man who looked to be at least 60 insisted that the patient's psychic problems had nothing to do with ethnicity. They instead stemmed from the universal need to be loved. Love, he said, quote, transcends culture, end quote. Another participant reflected on a patient's, quote, need to be understood as singular, end quote. Wasn't there something damaging about viewing a patient as just one among many people who shared an ethnicity, rather than as a unique individual? A third pushed back against the very premise of the discussion group, asking, how much is too much to think about culture? A younger participant responded, saying that he didn't think it was possible to draw a line. This debate resembled similar ones taking place in other spaces, from academia to medicine to journalism. It often splits along generational lines. On one side are the defenders of the old ways of doing things, of objectivity, rigor, and the universal human subject. On the other side are those who understand norms as culturally constructed. They often argue that the universal subject is always racially coded and that lived experience produces, or limits, certain forms of knowledge. This second camp usually suggests that the profession needs to find new and more equitable ways to do its work. The conversation during the discussion group remained decorous, but it was clear there was a lot at stake. Near the end of the session, Holmes acknowledged that the group was violating analytic tradition by attending so closely to the social and the cultural, categories that had historically been seen as beyond the purview of psychoanalysts. For some analysts, violating tradition can be a declaration of war. Quote, "Each side really feels that unless their side wins the day," Moss told me later, "there's going to be enormous damage," end quote. Moss and Holmes were at the vanguard of a burgeoning movement, what some called the profession's, quote, "social turn," end quote. Depending on whom you talk to, the social turn was an old tradition rightfully resurgent, a minor tendency now becoming major, a change necessary to the survival of the profession, or the death knell for psychoanalysis as we know it. Though many proponents of the social turn are experienced analysts, both Holmes and Moss were in their 70s. The approach is particularly attractive to younger clinicians, as well as to current analysts in training, who tend to be in their 30s or 40s. Many of these clinicians and candidates began psychoanalytic training in part because they wanted to fight for social justice. Some had become attuned to the inequities while training in social work, while others were drawn to psychoanalysis through exposure to the tradition's radicals, such as Frantz Fanon. To understand the social turn, Moss told me during a phone call after the meeting, you must do what an analyst does in the consulting room. Go back to the very beginning. Quote, when Freud established psychoanalysis, he made a very sharp division between what he called psychic reality and material reality, end quote, he explained. Freud thought that a patient's hysteria, say, wasn't primarily caused by the present conditions of that patient's life, but rather experiences and fantasies in very early childhood, especially those that took place within the nuclear family. These now resided in the patient's unconscious and contributed to their psychic reality. He was more concerned with a patient's feelings and fantasies about their experiences than with the experiences themselves. Many other factors shaping the patient's life, social and historical forces, verifiable facts and experiences, matters of money and race, were left outside the consulting room door. In some ways, the method Freud developed was a helpful one. It allowed him to bracket questions of, quote, what really happened, end quote, to his patients during their childhoods for the sake of doing psychoanalytic work of rigor and depth. Many analysts after Freud erected a similar wall, and the consulting room became a kind of sanctuary for the clinician as well as for the patient. Whatever was going on, quote, out there, end quote, liberation movements, economic depressions, wars, was secondary to what was going on, quote, in here, end quote. At their most extreme, American psychoanalysts were reluctant to discuss external realities. If anything, they encouraged their patients to adjust to them. Moss wanted to increase what he called the, quote, porosity, end quote, between psychoanalysis and the social. He had, by his own account, used his position as chair of the program committee to do just that. Quote, we've become responsive to a decades-long critique that we've ignored the social and the historical to no one's benefit, end quote, he told me. Moss had his allies. One of them was Francisco Gonzalez, an analyst based in the Bay Area. When we spoke by phone following the meeting, Gonzalez emphasized the importance of collectives to psychoanalysis throughout its history. From Freud's work in Civilization and Its Discontents to the community program that Gonzalez himself helped co-found as the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. For Gonzalez, the turn to the social was really a return to a politicized version of psychoanalysis that was present and even quite prominent at an earlier moment in the profession's history. Others saw the social turn as something new and dangerous. Some members of APSA feared that psychoanalysts were taking on problems that existing disciplines, such as sociology or political theory, were better equipped to analyze. Others worried that the social turn would cause analysts to abandon clinical neutrality, the poker-faced suspension of judgment that therapists cultivate, and turn them into, quote, avatars of anti-racism and social justice with each and every patient, end quote, as one Massachusetts-based psychoanalyst put it in a message to the APSA's email list, a forum where analysts debate issues affecting the profession. Still others questioned whether this perspective best served patients, who may be primed to see themselves as victims and their problems as the product of external forces. The analyst's job, according to some, is to push patients past superficial accounts of their suffering and ultimately to empower them to make different choices. This was how analysts could best affect change, not by addressing social problems, but by helping one individual at a time. But some advocates of the social turn insist instead that analysts, as individuals, and psychoanalysis as an intellectual discipline, can affect social change. Beverly Stute, a psychiatrist analyst in Atlanta, who at the time of the meeting sat on APSA's executive committee, believes that racial and ethnic violence is, quote, the modern question, end quote, and that with new social and historical approaches, psychoanalysts are becoming better equipped to answer it. She told me that if psychoanalysts can find ways to address this question, they could, quote, could really change the world, end quote. During the summer of 2020, as the Black Lives Matter movement was flourishing, APSA's executive committee approached the nonprofit Black Psychoanalysts Speak. Together, the organizations appointed Dorothy Holmes to build and chair an independent group to address race and racism within American psychoanalysis, with funding and administrative support provided by the association. She selected three co-chairs, all eminent clinicians of color. Stoat, Diane Powell, an analyst at Columbia University and the Psychoanalytic Association of New York, and Anton Hart, an analyst on the faculty at the William Allison White Institute. Together, they created a commission of 23 members and began conducting a systematic study of how issues of race are broached or not in psychoanalytic institutions across the country. On the fourth night of the meeting I attended, more than 500 people gathered in the hotel's largest conference room to hear a preview of the results. The crowd seemed noticeably more diverse than at other events. Later, Stoat said to me, quote, "So you were in that room. You now know most of the black psychoanalysts in the country," end quote. She estimated that about 0.2% of analysts in the United States are black. Holmes, after whom the commission was named, took the podium first. Dressed in a neat red skirt suit, she spoke matter-of-factly about the barriers she had faced as a black woman making her way through graduate and postgraduate study. She was followed by Hart and Powell, who described the commission's process, then Gonzalez and Stoat, who shared some of the results of the surveys they had conducted with candidates at training institutes. They told the audience that, according to data, racism, quote, "has been killing our institutes," end quote. Facing microaggressions and misunderstandings, candidates of color were dropping out and not even enrolling in the first place. The institutes didn't know how to deal with racial trauma, to the dissatisfaction of candidates and patients alike. Sweeping changes were needed, even if, Stoat suggested, those who ran the institutes were largely resistant to change, and those who wanted to change didn't know how. During the question and answer period, one white audience member after another spoke. They applauded the commission, though a few alluded to APSA members who might disapprove the changes at Holmes' commission report, set to be released 4.5 months later, would propose. Near the end of the session, a woman who looked to be younger than the average attendee stepped up to the mic. A woman of color, she explained, that she had recently dropped out of psychoanalytic training owing to the racism she experienced at the institute where she had been a candidate. When she received the Holmes Commission survey, the first thing she felt was rage. Quote, "You just want to take from me," end quote, she said she remembered thinking. Quote, "You just want to pick my brain to help you grow," end quote. But now that she understood the purpose of the survey, she was grateful. As she thanked the panelists for their efforts, her voice broke. It appeared to be a moment of catharsis for both the former candidate and for the group. Bad feelings have been aired. Mutual understanding seemed to have been reached. Later, Gonzalez told me that APSA was changing at long last. And, quote, "there's this kind of vibrancy through that change," end quote. The tensions on display at APSA between flexibility and rigidity, between freedom and repression, date to the dawn of psychoanalysis and were present too in its founder. If Freud defined psychoanalysis with a clear set of rules and criticized the, quote, "wild," end quote, version practiced by doctors untrained in his method, he also sometimes encouraged experimentation. In 1918, he imagined that a democratizing turn in the world would loosen the strictures he'd placed on psychoanalysis. In this, quote, fantastic, end quote, future, outpatient mental health clinics, staffed by those with analytic training, would provide treatment to the poor and the working class for free. When this happens, clinicians would have to, quote, alloy the pure gold of analysis freely with the copper of direct suggestion, end quote. During the interwar period, free clinics sprang up in 10 cities, including London, Vienna, and Berlin. According to the scholar Elizabeth Danto, the first and second generation of psychoanalysts devoted at least one-fifth of the clinical work to the urban poor. Still, many resisted change. Over time, as psychoanalysis became established, different tendencies hardened into factions, particularly in the United States, where, according to Hale, the most conservative analyst became, quote, more Freudian than Freud, end quote. When these analysts were in power, as they were for much of the 20th century, heterodox analysts, including Karen Horney, who challenged Freud's views on gender and founded what became known as the, quote, feminine psychology, end quote, were frequently marginalized. In the end, history took a cruel turn. The Nazi Party came to power in the 30s, threatening psychoanalysts, many of them Jews, communists, or both, with annihilation. Freud died on September 23, 1939, 22 days after World War II began, and didn't live to see the war's devastating effect on the psychoanalytic community. Many European analysts were imprisoned and killed. Others fled to the United States. The influx of emigre analysts was one among several reasons that took psychoanalysis took off in America after 1945. But anti-communist sentiment had forced some analysts to suppress their leftist politics. Gonzalez described this moment of collective repression to me as one of several traumatic moments in the history of the discipline that must be worked through. Quote, what's needed now is the psychoanalysis of psychoanalysis, end quote. Quote, psychoanalysis can go burn, end quote, said Samir Khan. Quote, we're here to serve patients, end quote. The future of the profession writ large was not Khan's concern. Khan, a psychiatrist in New York, is a friendly man in his 40s with long dark hair and an easy smile. We met in between sessions on the penultimate day of the conference. By that point, change was in the air. In panels and plenary addresses, speakers encouraged the audience to try out new clinical approaches and to resist change at their own risk. During one event, Kerry Sulkowitz, APSA's president, a slick figure who works in leadership and organizational consulting, took the stage to announce that a ballot measure loosening APSA's membership requirements had passed with 81% of the vote. Before, it had been the case that only MDs, PhDs, and social workers who had completed psychoanalytic training at an APSA institute could become full members of the association. But now others, therapists, academics, and researchers, who were trained in psychotherapy at APSA or equivalent institutes, could join the association with full membership. The change, quote, helps ensure our future, end quote, he said to a raucous applause. Khan was skeptical of all this celebration. Quote, is change nice? End quote, he asked rhetorically. Psychoanalysts, he told me, tend to romanticize change, fear, and uncertainty as if they were always productive. He seemed to doubt the social turn, not because he objected to training more analysts of color or to adjusting treatment plans to better reflect the patient population, but because he didn't think it would change the profession very much. Another skeptic declined to speak with me on the record, fearing being branded as a conservative or a racist. Some others I contacted refused to speak altogether. For all this talk of the social, there wasn't as much talk about how to make psychoanalysis more affordable to patients. APSA represented people who often earn six figures a year. Quote, it's like, yes, we want to do good, but also, how much do these pants cost? End quote. He asked, gesturing to the pair he was wearing. They cost $300. Quote, you're supposed to get people to talk about things so that everything can be metabolized, end quote, Khan said. But during many discussions, analysts of color were careful and controlled, as they had been in the discussion group on social and historical factors. They were inhibited. Such self-censorship was pragmatic. Those in power would resist change if they felt themselves threatened. What we had witnessed at the meeting might be reform rather than revolution, or worse, simply a self-congratulatory discussion of things that might never come to pass. Not long after the New York meeting, the American psychoanalytic community erupted. During planning for the June meeting, several committee members proposed inviting Lara Sheehy, an assistant professor of clinical psychology at George Washington University, known for her work on Palestine, to participate in a panel. Sheehy was being investigated by her own university and would later be investigated by the United States Department of Education. After Stand With Us, a pro-Israel advocacy group, filed a complaint with the department's Office for Civil Rights, alleging there had been an anti-Semitic discrimination in her classroom. APSA's executive committee, headed by Sulkowitz and President-elect Dan Prezant, forbade extending the invitation, claiming that organizers wouldn't be able to, quote, contain, end quote, reactions to an event with Sheehy. In response, the program committee ultimately refused to plan a June program entirely. The executive committee then disbanded the program committee. APSA's email list promptly went nuts. Discussion on the email list was vicious, with some posters supporting the executive committee's decision and others supporting the program committee. People leveled accusations of racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism at one another. APSA members on both sides claimed to feel, quote, unsafe, end quote. One member characterized those angry at the executive committee as, quote, birds of prey, end quote, who were, quote, willing to rip APSA apart, end quote. Another member told me that it felt like everyone had to pick a side. The weeks that followed were chaotic. It seemed the June meeting wouldn't happen. Then it was back on. It did, in the end, take place as planned. The program committee was gone for good. Then suddenly, reinstated. In a stunning reversal, the executive committee offered an apology to Sheehy, who had recently been cleared of wrongdoing by George Washington University, and in late March invited her to present at the June meeting after all. She declined and has since been cleared by the Department of Education's investigation. Less than 2 weeks after that, Sulkowitz, although self-described proponent of the social turn, sent a letter to membership resigning from his position as president of APSA and pointing fingers at an, quote, illiberal extreme left, end quote, that had, quote, asserted its exclusive occupancy of the moral high ground, end quote, and that aimed, quote, to transform APSA from a professional organization into a primarily political activist organization, end quote. He worried for the future of psychoanalysis. Quote, our tendency to turn against ourselves represents a social defense against psychoanalytic progress vis-a-vis the outside world. It may be our greatest risk, end quote. On Juneteenth, 2023, just days after the contested June meeting took place, the Holmes Commission released its report. Across 421 pages, the report offered a comprehensive account of the Commission's qualitative research methods, which involved surveying institute faculty, staff, administrators, and candidates, and following up a sample of these surveys with in-depth interviews, as well as its findings. The Commission found that many participants felt unequipped to address racism, that word-of-mouth recruitment methods led to majority-white training institutes, and that, quote, racial enactments, end quote, the manifestation of racist attitudes and behaviors, were common. The report recommended that training institutes focus on the recruitment and retention of candidates of color, that the curriculum of psychoanalytic training institutes be diversified, and that there be a, quote, top-down prioritization of issues of race and racism within psychoanalytic settings, end quote. Many of the training institutes affiliated with APSA, including those in Boston and Minneapolis, committed to organizing group readings of the report. It was understood that, as in analysis itself, meaningful change would take many years. Meanwhile, people were leaving. Some APS members, including members of color, and Sheehy herself resigned from the organization, citing controversy around the program committee and Sheehy's invitation as the reason. Others who had planned to join, like Khan, decided not to. Mitchell Wilson, an analyst in California and the former editor-in-chief of APSA's publication, the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, lamented the development. Quote, Having a younger set of folks who are theoretically sophisticated, politically active, and committed is incredibly important. And those people overall have left, end quote, he told me. Quote, that's a huge loss for some of us. I think for others, it's a relief, end quote. As 2024 began, analysts gathered once again in New York. With some of the more progressive members of APSA absent, the gathering felt more relaxed, though also less energetic. Some months after the meeting, Moss was replaced as leader of the program committee, and the committee was reduced in size. Quote, very deflating for many of us, end quote, Moss wrote to me in an email. The Holmes Commission concluded its formal work in February 2024. At that year's New York meeting, the commission held a panel for what it called, quote, collective processing, end quote, of the report. In an email, Gonzalez, who, like several people I spoke to, did not attend a 2024 meeting, said a number of commission members were then working to establish the Consultation Liaison Network, which he described as, quote, network of individuals working psychoanalytically with a shared interest in race work, diversity, and generally a more inclusive and progressive psychoanalysis, end quote, that could coordinate with training institutes on issues of race and that would be entirely independent of APSA. Quote, I think there's going to be a lot of splintering, end quote, said Kahn, when we reconnected in the spring of 2024. Cheerful and loquacious during our previous encounter, he now seemed more despondent, muted. The past year had been, quote, sucky, end quote. He'd fallen out with his own analyst over the war in Gaza, stopped treatment, distanced himself from APSA, and like other clinicians of color, felt, quote, a general jadedness, end quote, about institutional psychoanalysis. He'd attended only one event at the 2024 New York meeting, the Holmes Commission panel. Quote, you make your environment inhospitable, and then minorities leave, end quote, he explained. Quote, APSA was like a beacon. You could go there, you could hear people, and you could get inspired. You could be like, oh, maybe I want to be an analyst, end quote. Now younger and more progressive analysts would have to seek out the splinter groups, which are smaller and less well known. He wasn't sure they would find them. Like many institutions in the early 2020s, APSA felt compelled to change, to diversify its membership, to address racism, to speak to the political moment. But it seemed to Kahn the moment for change had passed. The social turn had its problems, and many, if not all, of its critics raised their questions in good faith, but it had drawn an influx of clinicians and researchers to a profession in desperate need of new blood. Without them, the American psychoanalytic community might well remain a homogeneous group of aging professionals talking among themselves. Quote, I think it's going to be more of the same, but in a more aggressive way, end quote, Kahn told me. Quote, because you have to do a lot more aggressive things to stay the same, end quote. Harper's Magazine, April 2025, under the heading Findings. Rabbits are capable of digesting their teeth as they wear down and reusing the calcium to grow new ones. Chinese scientists successfully raised to adulthood mice born of two fathers and dissected them. Mice who inhale xenon gas stave off dementia. Estrogen receptor 1, expressing neurons in Barrington's nucleus, were found to act as the master controller of mouse urination. In a survey of 1,328 urinary events found that, unlike contagious yawning, the contagious urination of chimpanzees appears to be correlated to social rank rather than social closeness. Researchers in Namibia, who shone lasers on wild Kakaman baboons, found that the monkeys failed to recognize themselves in mirrors, but also did not regard their reflections as strangers. Coyotes in dense areas of Chicago die younger if the average human income is high. Scientists found no evidence that radiation is to blame for the genetic differentiation among dogs at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Birds who drape snakeskin on their cavity nest deter predators, and it is possible that songbirds who migrate at night socialize with one another in flight and speak to other species. Costa Rican white-faced capuchins were more likely to survive El Nino if their feces exhibited higher levels of stress hormones during preceding droughts. Suicides appear to rise following droughts, but not floods, hurricanes, or tornadoes. Nor, among the Maori, they appear to correspond to lunar cycles. A medieval Italian fresco was found to depict a church's altar draped in an Islamic tent, and a skull previously thought to belong to Cleopatra's sister was found to be that of an Italian boy with a deformed jaw. Experimental reenactments suggested that at Little Muck Shelter, trimming ostrich eggshells beads before perforating them was slightly more successful than perforating before trimming. The moon, which the World Monuments Fund declared to be at risk, was found to be more geologically dynamic than previously thought. Neolithic Danes may have sacrificed sunstones following the disappearance of the sun. Iron Age Britons were Metaloko, and a Viking grave in Norway appeared to contain a vulva stone. French archaeologists discovered a Gaulish curse tablet tucked between a skeleton's legs. Fifty-two experts were consulted to produce a 6-criteria test for predicting vasectomy regret. Researchers unveiled an androgen clock that measures hormone exposure in mice and sheep by examining their DNA and concluded that more fights a male mouse wins, the less essential dopamine becomes to his aggression. Forestalgia is more effective than nostalgia in vacation marketing. An infradian clock may control the alternation between depression and mania. Ambien inhibits the brain's ability to wash itself during deep sleep. Swedes with a history of psychosis-induced violence exhibit a lower threshold for resisting auditory startles, and Swedes born prematurely likely receive too little pain medication. Among college students, gain muscle. American college students gain muscle rather than fat during the holidays. American parents tend to exhibit a slight preference for their offspring who are younger, female, or more agreeable. And the recent increase in the number of American babies lost to sudden unexpected infant death may be attributable to respiratory viruses, parental opiate use, and unsafe co-sleeping practices popularized through social media. Severe autism reduces the time children spend looking at cute stimuli. Harper's Magazine, May 2025, under the heading Analysis, titled Little White Lies, from a Department of Justice report on the Tulsa race massacre that was published in January before President Biden left office and conducted by its Cold Case Unit, Civil Rights Division. Shortly after the massacre, Harry Daugherty, the U.S. Attorney General, announced an, quote, informal, end quote, investigation to determine whether any federal laws have been violated. The matter was assigned to the Department of Justice's Bureau of Investigation, a precursor to today's FBI, Agent T.F. Weiss, acting under instruction from Agent James G. Finley, sent a preliminary assessment to the Bureau Chief by telegram on June 2, 1921, the day after the massacre. The telegram said that, quote, no federal violation appears, end quote. Weiss's later report from June 6 concluded that the incident had not been a, quote, race riot, end quote, as it was not, in his words, the, quote, result of racial feeling or agitators, end quote. Instead, Weiss claimed that the incident began as just a, quote, small, quote, and, quote, half-hearted, quote, attempt to lynch an innocent man, and that the situation, quote, spontaneously, end quote, grew out of control. While he claimed that he had talked to more than 100 witnesses, both black and white, Weiss summarized only 5 interviews, all with white men. Although Weiss admitted that those witnesses, whom he stressed, quote, did not condone, end quote, the actions of the white mob, were all, quote, a little prejudiced, end quote, against the black community, he did not include accounts from any individual black witnesses. Instead, his report cursorily stated that all black witnesses told, quote, the same story, end quote, of, quote, hearing shots, seeing houses set on fire, and fleeing for their lives, some of their members who had guns shooting as they fled, end quote. Although only a day had passed since the witnesses' experience of these events, the report noted that all the black witnesses had a, quote, optimistic attitude, end quote, about their situation. In fact, Weiss asserted that by June 2, the day after the massacre, white and black residents of Tulsa were, quote, mingling amicably on the streets of Tulsa, end quote, a virtual impossibility, given that the city was under martial law and most black residents were in detention or performing manual labor.